something, the wistful melody of an oboe. She followed it and found the thread again. The music accompanied Nikolai's magic, not like the orchestra at his party on the Nevar. This was as quiet as the lullaby a bird murmurs to its unhatched eggs. Had music always been there? Beaker knew that the answer had to be yes, only she hadn't noticed, because she'd been too busy trying to kill Nikolai during the game, or at least not be killed herself, and she'd only seen what his power could do on the surface. She'd never listened, never delved deeper.
What else is there, Nikolai?
With her eyes still firmly shut, Beaker walked past the pink and red flowers she'd planted along the gravel path, and turned onto the main promenade. The oaks rustled above, and the birds warbled a folk tune. But these were all Vika's creations, so she ignored them. She held fast to that single wisp of silk, though, with its melancholy oboe, and as soon as she moved near the first dream bench, she was hit by the fragrance of sun-drenched grass mixed with mandarin and... was that time?
Nikolai!
It was not as if he smelled of all those things, or any of them, for that matter. Not when Vika had been in his physical presence. And yet the combination was the steppe and St. Petersburg, French and Russian, all at once. It was the perfumed footprint of his magic, another dimension Vika had never noticed before. How had she missed so much of him? And was it lost completely now, to the darkness that consumed him? Vika worried her bottom lip. The fragrance and the music led her past the Moscow bench, past the ones for Kostroma, Kizhi Island, and Yekaterinburg, until she arrived at the bench for Lake Baikal in Siberia. She lowered herself onto the bench, slowly enveloped by the pale purple mist that surrounded it. She inhaled, and then she dozed off. Vika woke on the other side of the bench in the dream world of Lake Baikal. Before her spread a sapphire pool of fathomless blue, pure glacial water in a crater created by a volcano. Violet-gray mountains surrounded the lake on all sides, and a cool breeze blew across the water, even though it was summer here. Vika gasped as she stood and looked around. But she'd hiked these mountains before, in the dream, and they had been just as beautiful. What was it that was drawing her here now? What was special about this place?
Nikolai!
She said aloud.
I'm here! I'm looking for you! Where are you?
A trail appeared before her, as if the mountains had opened and created a new ridge for her to follow. Although when she inspected it more closely, the mountains hadn't moved at all. But wasn't that the beauty of Nikolai? He could be so contradictory. He could appear to be one thing and be something else entirely, brooding and ambitious, yet joyful and self-sacrificing. Of course his magic could be opposites at once as well. Vika hiked along the path that was and wasn't there, leading her between two of the violet mountains. The sky here was so blue it seemed counterfeit.
But of course it is, Vika thought. This is Nikolai's creation. He can make the sky any color he pleases.
On distant peaks, animals moved. Perhaps deer hopping from ledge to ledge, or wolves out for a hunt. Vika's trail was quiet, save for her boots crunching on the rock, the path behind her disappearing as she walked, the one before her unfurling with each step forward. As she pushed onward, the music grew louder, almost audible to a normal ear now. What a strange sensation to be hiking alone through the mountains of Siberia with an oboe accompanying her. At one point, she looked back over her shoulder, and Lake Baikal was nowhere to be seen. It was impossible to judge the distance she traversed. For all she knew, Nikolai could be leading her to the Arctic Circle now. But she continued walking. Not only because there was no trail back, but also because the tugging in her chest grew stronger. This was a path solely for her, and no one else. She had to follow it to its end. and then the season changed abruptly. Vika's eyelashes froze at the tips, and she shivered, even though she wore her coat from the real St. Petersburg winter. A gust of snow blasted at her and nearly knocked her off the path, which had now become a tightrope of sorts, a thin line of pebbles floating over a vast abyss, with nothing but sharp crags and the gaping mouth of a valley below.
"I can't die in a dream. I can't die in a dream," Vika told herself.
But she couldn't stop her heart from pounding when it seemed as if she really could slip and fall to her death at any moment. Why had the terrain suddenly changed? It was as if Nikolai had wanted her to find him, but now that she had come, he had changed his mind. Was she supposed to turn back? But how? Even the tightrope disappeared behind her, leaving the tiny stepping stones ahead of her as her only option. Or perhaps it was a test of her own will, and whether she really wanted to find him or not. The magic of Nikolai's dreams swirled around her, the silkiness and the perfume sliding against her skin, the oboe crescendoing.
"He's not just a shadow boy with darkness in his veins."
The thought came to Vika like a recollection, like she'd forgotten he was an actual person, and only now remembered, truly remembered, that Nikolai was complex and real. She had made a similar error earlier with Pasha, forgetting he was more than the black-and-white caricature she'd painted of him in her head. She would not make the same mistake with Nikolai.
"I do want to find you,"
she thought, as if he could hear her. The sky turned dark, like midnight, and the tightrope vanished. Vika shrieked at the sudden changes and grasped at the air, as if she could hold on to the nothingness to break her fall. She began to plummet like Icarus from the sky. A golden eagle, larger than any in real life, soared down from the moon. It dove straight at her, but then caught Vika on its back.
"Oh, thank heavens!"
She nestled into its warm brown feathers and lay herself flat across its back, not wanting to ride it like a horse and be blown off by the wind, for the eagle careened through the sky at near reckless speed. Her ears popped as the eagle darted in and out of the clouds, and Vika's hair trailed behind her like a flame, so bright that if anyone were watching, she and the eagle would appear to be a shooting star streaking across the night. Vika's heart skittered like a frightened rabbit, but against her ear, she could hear the eagle's pulse beating steady and strong. She tried to calm her own heartbeat. Then it occurred to her that this was the type of magic she would have thrilled at before the game, before Nikolai tried to kill Pasha, before she was suspicious of everything Nikolai did. Vika half smiled. She sat up on the eagle's back now, opened her eyes, and tried to enjoy this respite from reality, the cold night air blowing across her face. She looked at the stars above them, and it was as if they were sailing through the immense sea of midnight, explorers charting oceans where no one else had ever been. Nikolai's oboe was now joined by an entire symphony, and the woodwinds crooned along with the gentle melody of the strings, the chimes ringing softly like a sprinkle of starlight. The eagle soared faster, and Vika whooped, smiling broadly now, feeling alive even though she was asleep, feeling whole even though half of her lay on the other side of the bench. Magic! How she had missed it! The eagle landed softly at the top of another mountain, but it had taken only two steps when the ground trembled beneath them. Steam and heat and the stench of sulfur rose nearby. Vika froze. A volcano. Like the one on which Sergei had found her. An exact replica, it seemed, of the volcano etching he'd carved into her wardrobe at home. Vika touched her scarf. Her mother's basalt pendant lay beneath it. Only the necklace wasn't there, for she'd given it to Pasha. Her throat suddenly seemed too exposed, despite being covered with a thick layer of wool.
"Why did you bring me here?"
The eagle shrieked. She couldn't understand it, because she couldn't use magic to translate what it said. The eagle growled and shook her off its back. Without waiting for her to move out of the way, it flapped its great wings and took off into the air, leaving her stranded on the mountainside. Vika clung to a small shrub to avoid being blown away. She shivered in the snow, but when the eagle was gone, she rose and brushed the ice off her coat.
"I am fierce,"
she said, repeating what Ludmila had said of her.
"This is only a dream. I refuse to allow something as silly as an imaginary eagle and a made-up volcano to rattle me."
She walked quickly, proudly, to the edge of the crater, as if this would further prove her point. But it was not a cauldron of lava, as Vika had expected. Rather, it was a long, narrow tunnel that went straight down, like a cylinder bored into the volcano. Vika bit her lip. There was nowhere else for her to go but down. The only other option was to wake herself from this dream, and that was not an option, for Vika did not simply back away because something was perilous. Like caution, quitting on account of danger was not a part of her lexicon. She looked at the hole again. It was a perfect circle, something created not from nature, but by something or someone else. She latched onto a nearby tree and leaned over the edge of the opening.
"Hello!"
she called down. Pure, untainted silk swirled up to meet her. And then...
"Bonsoir, Vika!"
She'd found Nikolai. Chapter 56. Nikolai could see her silhouette, framed by the imaginary moonlight coming through the circular opening above him. He hadn't known if she would come, or if she would be able to without the use of magic, but he thought that if they were still connected, as they'd been before the end of the game, then... perhaps there was hope for them yet. After all, she'd come to his house. It was possible, now that Pasha had taken away her magic, that Nikolai could convince her to join him.
"I'm coming down!"
Vika yelled. Before Nikolai could answer, Vika simply dropped straight from the hole in the ceiling, plummeting quickly at first, but then floating down like a feather to the ground. In fact, she was riding on a feather, from the golden eagle he'd conjured to bring her here.
"You do know how to make an entrance,"
Nikolai said. She curtsied.
"What are we doing in this volcano?"
he asked, still hanging back in the shadow, out of the moonlight. Vika stuck her hands on her hips.
"Funny. I thought you would be able to tell me. You didn't create this."
Nikolai shook his head as he took in the porous black rock that constituted the walls of the cylindrical room around him, and sulfur nipped at his nose. He had no connection with volcanoes. Vika was the one whose mother was a volcano nymph.
"I just reconnected myself to the magic that created the dream bench," he said. "But I didn't dare enter it fully. I thought I might get stuck again." "So you're not sitting on the bench with me right now?" "No. I'm nearby, though." "This is neutral ground for us to meet, then."
Vika gestured to the dark room, which was incredibly detailed, being, uniquely, a cell carved in the depths of a seething volcano, and at the same time, blandly black and nondescript.
"I still don't quite know how we created it," Nikolai said. "It's as if you've tapped into my magic to combine something of yours with mine. Except I'm not casting any enchantments right now."
Nikolai frowned. He'd forgotten for a second that she couldn't use magic. But if not, then how was it that his thoughts were blending with something of Vika's? Was it because he'd taken apart her egg and touched her energy then? Or did it go farther back, to the end of the game, when he'd given her nearly all of his?
"I'm not allowed to use magic,"
Vika said, as if Nikolai didn't know about Pasha's edict.
"I've been declared illegal by the Tsardom."
I'm sorry about that," he said,
which was not at all a sufficient answer, but it was the only one Nikolai could come up with, as he was still wading through his own questions.
"Not as sorry as I am,"
Vika frowned. This brought him away from his thoughts, and he smiled. She was so pretty, even when she was piqued. Even more so, actually. because it made her wildness glint in her eyes. Nikolai wanted to kiss her. The old version of him would have held back, but this one, with ambition and audacity in his veins, didn't. He took one long stride and wrapped his arm around Vika's waist. She froze. Nikolai bent his head and crushed his mouth against hers. His shadow had substance enough that although he blurred slightly into her, he could still feel the warmth and softness of her lips. Vika gasped and pulled back. She gaped at him. But then she reached her hand to the back of his head and drew him down and smashed her mouth against his. She kissed ferociously, just like her enchantments. Her lips parted, and their tongues found each other and danced like their mazurka at the masquerade, frenzied and hot. Their bodies pressed closer. Nikolai's edges blurred into hers. Kissing Vika was like consuming fire and being consumed by fire all at once. It heated away some of the chill that coursed through him. And this was a kiss that wasn't even real. It was happening between figments of themselves in a dream. How would it feel to kiss Vika on the other side of the bench? She ripped her mouth away. Nikolai let out a small breath, still wanting.
"I don't know what to do with you,"
Vika said, her face only inches from his. She seemed torn between wanting to lean in again and wanting to run away. Nikolai looked at her, but didn't say anything. He couldn't.
"We're tied together, you and I," she said. "But I don't know if I'm drawn to you because I'm supposed to love you, or if it's because we're destined always to fight."
"Perhaps it's both," he managed to say.
"I don't want it to be both."
He cast his facade so he would look like the boy she'd once trusted. He held out his hand to her.
"Then reconsider my offer. Join me."
Chapter 57. He looked precisely how Vika remembered him before he'd become a shadow. Like a poisonous autumn crocus, deadly beautiful with no antidote. Her breath caught and her entire body went weak for a moment, just like at the masquerade ball during the game. It took a great deal of restraint not to take his hand or to reach up and caress the elegantly sharp lines of his face. But, hard as it was, Vika resisted. Nikolai held her gaze, though, and she couldn't look away.
"Why did you come to my house?" he finally asked.
She blinked and broke from the trance induced by his eyes. Had he done that to her on purpose, or was it merely a side effect of being near Nikolai? Both, most likely.
"I wanted to see you," she managed to say. "Is that the only reason?"
There were many reasons, but right now, wanting to see him seemed to overshadow them all.
"It's the only reason that matters," she said.
The walls in the black room suddenly glowed with specks of orange, as if lava had been resting deep inside, and now came closer to the surface through the basalt's pores. Vika's heart slammed against the bodice of her dress. Nikolai's new brand of magic, cold and smooth, wrapped like black silk around them. Vika shivered as he looked down at her, and she up at him.
"I'm sorry about your mother," she said.
"I'm not." His eyes, despite his shroud, were still shadow. But they shaded even darker after he said that. The lava behind Vika began to seep out of the walls, viscous and too slow to be a threat yet, but definitely hotter. Nikolai grasped her arms. Whether to keep her with him, or out of instinct to protect her from the lava, she didn't know. She also didn't know if she wanted to break free from his hold. A different sort of heat ran through her at his touch, fire through her core. And to think, they weren't actually even touching each other. This was a fantasy. Their real selves were elsewhere.
"May I have the honor of dancing with you?" Nikolai asked.
Vika looked all around. The lava had flowed down the walls into the floor now, pooling and flaring in a circle around them.
"Here?"
"Why not?" She didn't move.
"Why now?"
"Because you didn't take my hand earlier when I offered it. You came to my house,
but you haven't decided yet what to do with me. So I must convince you. Perhaps a dance will do it. And if not, well, it's possible you or I may die soon. Truly die. With you on Pasha's side and me on mine. And if that's the case, then I would like to have danced with you once more. She hesitated. But perhaps, if he still loves me as he did during the game, a dance will remind him of what he used to be like. Perhaps I can still help him. What shall we dance? She asked. I must warn you, I don't know the waltz or the polonaise or anything fancy.
He laughed, and in that laugh she heard a small measure of the former Nikolai. Her breath hitched with hope.
You know the mazurka,
he said. Music began to play in the volcano, a very lively tune. But she didn't, not anymore. Nikolai had changed too much, and her heart had forgotten their rhythm. Yet when he offered his hand again, there was no possibility of her saying no, even if he'd wanted her to dance with him off the edge of the earth, because the mazurka was the essence of their beings. Nikolai held one of Vika's hands in his, and placed her other hand on his shoulder, before wrapping his free arm around the middle of her back. Suddenly, she remembered how it had felt to dance with him at Pasha's masquerade.
Will you trust me?
He had asked.
To do what?
To dance for you?
No,
Vika had said. Nikolai had shrugged.
No matter. I'm not giving you a choice.
Then magic had rushed around her and levitated her off the floor. Without needing to think, Vika and Nikolai had glided and spun, swiveled and sidestepped, a blur of movement together, as if lifted by the music and the wind. Vika wanted to feel that again. Here, now, in this volcano dream.
Charm my feet,
she breathed into Nikolai's ear.
Like at the masquerade.
He squeezed her hand and pulled her closer. Smooth black silk unfurled around Vika, chilling and beguiling her at the same time. But she would not let go of Nikolai. The lava swirled ever closer around them. The music flared. Their feet glided over the black rock, their bodies turning and stepping and twirling in perfect unison. It turned out that her heart had not forgotten the mazurka after all, merely locked its memory deep inside to protect her. But now the lava glowed brighter, and everywhere there was black silk and orange flame, and Vika was a wild girl with fiery hair, dancing with the Prince of Darkness, and not caring that they spun together through this imagined hell. They danced at a furious pace, blowing up all the dust from the volcano floor and surrounding themselves in a whirlwind of it. Vika's boots lifted off the ground, and Nikolai levitated too, and soon enough they were dancing above the lava, weaving in and out of the plumes of smoke. Vika let out an insouciant laugh. Eventually, though, the song ended, and Vika and Nikolai floated back down to the ground. Their breath still came and went with the rhythm, inhales and exhales in triple time. They held on to each other longer than they needed to.
I love you, Vika, he said softly. Nothing about that has changed, but everything else has.
He tightened his grip on her arms, and a surge of his magic, a black part of it that he'd kept cleverly hidden from her until now, swept through her, skittering like a thousand centipedes that nipped at her with their venomous beaks. She gasped at their touch. Vika shivered, despite the lava creeping nearly to where they stood in the center of the room. Nikolai's magic couldn't keep her warm. It could only take from her and from everyone else. She tried to break away, but she couldn't. This was his dream bench, his creation, and she was just an ordinary girl.
If you joined me against Pasha, we could dance like this together forever, he said. Tsar and Tsarina, magic on the throne.
She shuddered at the ambitious lust in his tone.
What would a Nikolai like this do once he had power? There would be no one to counter him.
No one, unless Vika stood her ground against him. The sense of duty and of what was right that Sergei had instilled in her burned in her core.
"I don't want to rule Russia with you," she said. "We would be magnificent." "No, we would be terrible."
Nikolai exhaled slowly, in that haunting, painful way only a shadow could. It was impossible to know whether he was angry or disappointed, or if he could see at all the truth of that particular future.
"But..."
Vika looked up at him. She remembered his laugh from not too long ago, the glimmer of the old Nikolai still buried inside this one.
"I do love you."
He pulled back a little in surprise.
"You don't act like it." "I do. The Nikolai I once knew would see it."
He shook his head, as if doing so would obliterate the truth that there was a difference between him and who he'd once been.
"Please stop whatever you're planning. Your mother's energy taints you. But together, I'm sure we could still make things right."
He furrowed his brow. "I doubt that." He turned as if to go.
"Nikolai, wait."
He didn't look at her again, but he hesitated, his hand still in hers. It was something, more than something. She would hold on to it as long as she could.
"No matter what happens," Vika said, "don't forget."
"Forget what?"
"That I love you."
His fingers tightened around hers for a brief moment.
"I love you too,"
he whispered. He shook himself and disappeared from the dream. Vika stayed, looking at the spot where Nikolai had stood. Only minutes later, however, the walls of the volcano began to tremble. No, not just tremble, but quake. Chunks of basalt rained down on her, and lava began to roar into the room. Vika shrieked and backed into a corner.
"Don't be afraid, my dear,"
a voice that sounded eerily similar to Vika's said, echoing throughout the cylindrical chamber.
"You were born of this. It won't hurt you."
Vika pressed herself against the wall anyway. She stretched and yawned and shook herself awake, just as the lava began to lick at the soles of her boots. She gasped as she jolted upright on the dream bench. She gulped in the fresh air, no fire and ash here. Then she hurried back to the dock for a ferry.
"I'm really beginning to hate dreams."
Chapter 58. A guard knocked on Yuliana's antechamber door and announced Pasha. She looked up from where she'd been working at her desk. Pasha frowned as he walked in. He took in the room, still full of letters and envelopes, then looked pointedly at Yuliana.
"Who are you?" "What?"
She scrunched her nose.
"This room is a disaster. My sister would never tolerate something like this. Therefore, you are clearly an imposter."
Yuliana could see the grin itching to break at the edge of his mouth.
"Very funny. I thought so."
He allowed himself to grin now, and cleared a small space on the chaise longue. He picked up an envelope as he sat down.
"So tell me, why is it such a mess in here?"
Yuliana rose and grabbed her notes from the desk, then wove through a thin break between the stacks of papers. Pasha shifted on the chaise to make space for her.
"These are mother's things,"
she said as she sat down beside him. Pasha nodded.
"I recognize her perfume on the pages, but that doesn't answer my question of why it appears a storm has blown through your quarters." "I went through her letters to figure out who your father was."
Yuliana shoved her notes at Pasha. There were pages and pages of neat columns, listing dates and descriptions of the contents of each letter. His grin disappeared.
"I'm afraid to ask what you've discovered."
Yuliana scooted closer to him and took back her notes, shuffling through them until she found what she was looking for.
"Well, to be honest, I haven't found anything definitive yet. The rumors are that Mother and Okotnikov were involved early in 1808, right? Which would mean he could be your father, since you were born in October that year. And yet, look."
She pointed to several entries, dated 1807.
These are the letters in which Mother's friends console her over the loss of the candle that lit her nights. From what I can gather from her other correspondence, that's code for her lover.
Pasha leaned in for a better look. Yuliana could hear that he was holding his breath.
He died in 1807, Pasha said.
She nodded.
I think so. But you're not sure. I'm going to keep reading.
Pasha rose and kissed his sister on the top of her head.
I'll check the Imperial Army's historical rosters. That ought to give us an answer for good.
She looked up at him.
All right. But be careful.
He tilted his head quizzically.
It's been too quiet since Nikolai tried to kill us with the carriage made of swords. He's up to something.
Pasha sighed, but then he nodded.
I'll figure out what he is doing.
Chapter 59. The soldier on duty at the Imperial Army's office was asleep at his desk. Pasha frowned. He had gone to all the trouble of disguising himself as an infantryman from a regiment out of town, complete with a story about why he needed to access his uncle's records for an honor his fabricated city was bestowing upon said uncle. But it seemed all his preparations were unnecessary. It was also a bit disappointing that this was what a soldier in Pasha's army did when no one was looking. Then again, this was a records office, not an outpost at the edges of the Ottoman Empire. Even Pasha had to admit that if his job was sitting at this desk, he'd nap to pass the time too. He slipped into the back of the office, past the snoring soldier, and availed himself of the files in the drawers. The records were tidy, and this was certainly something of which Pasha could be proud. The Imperial Army was one of the finest in Europe, from their fighting against Napoleon down to their polished boots, from their wisdom of their commanders to the documentation for every soldier. So precise, it was as if Yuliana herself had made the notations for each one. Pasha rifled through the yellowed papers, working backward in time until he found 1807.
Please, let there be a record here of Okotnikov's death.
He peeked through the door to the soldier out front, and upon hearing him still snoring, pulled a fat stack of papers from the drawer. Pasha sat with them on the floor, out of the soldier's line of sight, in case he woke. Records of new recruits, of retirements, of promotions and approvals for sick leave. And then, a notice of death.
Alexis Okotnikov, staff captain of the guard. Cause of death, stabbing. Assailant unknown.
Pasha's breath came fast and shallow. He clutched the paper to his chest, squeezed his eyes shut, and leaned back against the wall. Before he'd left Yuliana's chambers, she'd shown him the rest of her notes. After the loss of the candle that lit her nights, there were no more mentions of other lovers, and the Tsarina began to write her friends more of the Tsar's renewed attention to her, and then of her pregnancy. With Okotnikov's death record still in his hand, Pasha covered his face and processed the information.
I really am a Romanov, he whispered. I am the Cesarevich. The crown belongs to me.
His voice shook as he uttered the words. No, not just words. The truth. But then he suddenly pulled his hands from his face and sat upright. Just because he was the legitimate heir didn't mean his accession was guaranteed. Plenty of kingdoms had been wrenched from their rightful rulers. Nikolai had been relentless in pursuing the crown. He wouldn't stop simply because Pasha had evidence that he was first in line. Pasha pounded the floor with a fist and got to his feet. His job was not done. For now he knew for certain he was supposed to be Tsar.
And I'm going to prove it.
Outside one of the larger barracks, a crowd several men deep was ringed around a pair of wrestlers, who circled each other, shirtless. The snow had been cleared half an hour ago, when the soldiers had grown listless and had too much to drink. They'd managed to procure 3 crates of vodka from an unattended cart on Sadovia Street, and now they pummeled out their boredom with fists and wages, and, of course, more vodka. Pasha, still in disguise as a soldier from another regiment, threw himself into their midst. If he was going to rule the empire, he had to do so in a way that worked for him, diving into the reality of his people. Pasha had attended a recent imperial council meeting, though, much to the council members' surprise, and he'd learned that the constitutionalists were leveraging Nikolai's fate and the evils of magic to bring the army to their side. Until now, only a minority faction of the nobility had supported the idea of a constitutional monarchy, and even then, it had been an academic, almost theoretical discussion. But recruiting common soldiers was alarming, because it took a philosophical idea from fancy parlors and turned it into a real potential threat. Ilya had turned out to be a lousy spy. He hadn't overheard anything worthy to report, so now Pasha had to see for himself if it was true.
"Hey, you gonna make a wager? Bogdan or Grigori?"
A soldier lurched toward the group of men beside Pasha.
"Nah,"
one of them said.
"Not stupid enough to bet on the bear with such pathetic odds, and not drunk enough to put money on the scrawny one."
The soldier laughed and slapped him on the back.
"Hear, hear."
Bogdan was indeed a bear of a man, not only in size, but also in the sheer amount of fur on his chest, and he'd beaten 5 straight soldiers in the last 15 minutes. He took a swig from a bottle offered him from one of his friends, and paced the snowless ground some more. Grigori was smaller. He was slower too, both in wit and actual speed, but he was far less drunk than Bogdan, which made him a contender. He bounced on the soles of his boots as Bogdan cracked his knuckles.
"I'll wager Grigori wins this match,"
Pasha said. The soldier lifted a brow. Then he grinned.
"Well, well, a patron for David in his battle against Goliath. How much?"
Pasha was tempted to toss in twice whatever the highest gamble had been. But right then, Bogdan slammed an elbow into Grigori's nose and left his face a fountain of blood. Pasha heard Yuliana's voice in his head, reprimanding him for being too impetuous, and so he reluctantly said,
"The minimum."
The soldier snorted.
"Not actually much of a patron, are you?
Just not comfortable with too much risk,"
Pasha said, which wasn't true at all. Yuliana was the rule follower. Pasha was the one always getting scolded for taking risks, but he passed a rumpled bill and a few coins to the soldier anyway. As soon as the money exchanged hands, Bogdan smashed his fist into Grigori's chest, and Grigori collapsed onto the cold ground. Bogdan hovered. The ring of soldiers went silent as they waited. Grigori didn't move. Bogdan dropped his defensive stance and stepped closer to Grigori. Someone shouted from the crowd,
"You better not have killed him!"
Grigori groaned and rolled onto his back. The soldier who was acting as judge shouted,
"Bogdan wins again!"
Bogdan flexed his biceps and grunted. The man next to Pasha slapped him on the back. He reeked of vodka, and he slurred as he asked,
"Who are you, stranger? Anyone here would know that wagering against Bogdan is always a losing bet."
Pasha gave the man beside him a practiced look of dismay.
"I'm on leave from my company outside St. Petersburg, just here visiting family. I ought to refrain from betting at all, for I enjoy it when the dark horse wins, and I bet on them more often than not. But they're dark horses for a reason."
The soldier offered Pasha a half-drunk bottle of vodka.
"Drown the loss?"
Pasha grabbed the bottle by its neck and took a long swig, wiping his mouth afterward with his sleeve, and being careful not to disturb his temporary moustache. He handed the bottle back to the soldier.
"Thank you,
name's Yuri."
"Just Yuri, no patronymic."
It was odd to introduce oneself without the middle name that honored one's father. Then again, Yuri wasn't exactly steady on his feet at the moment. It was perhaps a feat for him to remember any part of his name at all. Yuri took another drink.
"My mother was rather, shall we say, popular in her youth. You know, Like the late Tsarina!
Yuri laughed, spitting sloppily as he did so. Pasha drew back a fist.
How dare you insult her Imperial Majesty! My apologies. Were you one of her lovers?
Yuri grinned. Pasha was about to swing at Yuri when someone behind him caught his arm.
Hey!
Bogdan growled, spinning Pasha around to face him.
No punching the drunkards. It's not fair. I'll fight you instead, pretty boy.
Pasha looked up at Bogdan. The fur on his chest was matted with sweat. His muscles flexed. He was a real-life Goliath. But Pasha seethed with indignation, and he wasn't about to back down. Besides, it would be embarrassing and dishonorable to back down.
Fine, he said. If you want to pay for Yuri's insult, I'll fight you. But since you talk of fairness, let's account for the obvious size. I propose we use swords rather than fists to make it an even fight.
Pasha was the best fencer in St. Petersburg. He stood a chance with swords.
Whatever you want. Doesn't matter, 'cause I don't lose.
Bogdan cracked his knuckles. The drunk soldiers around them looked from Bogdan to Pasha for a moment. Then a cheer swept the crowd.
Fight! 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 Fight!
The soldier who'd been serving as judge of the wrestling matches appeared with two swords. He gave Pasha first choice. Pasha picked up both blades and weighed them in his hands. He chose the lighter one. Not as strong, but easier to maneuver. Agility was often underestimated in the face of strength. Bogdan grabbed his sword with one hand and his crotch with the other. The gesture that followed was the opposite of polite. All right, this wouldn't be anything like the gentlemanly fencing matches to which Pasha was accustomed, but he'd adjust. It couldn't be that different, could it? Bogdan swung his sword in a broad arc, viciously enough to sever Pasha's head. Pasha yelped and leaped backward. Never mind, it was very different.
Pretty boy is quick on his feet,
Bogdan said. The crowd jeered. Pasha advanced and attacked. Bogdan parried and lunged at Pasha. Pasha deflected and attacked again. Their swords moved quickly, like flashes of violently choreographed silver. Once in the rhythm of the fight, it was not so different from the beat of fencing. Parry, riposte. Parry, riposte. Parry, riposte. Deflect, attack. Deflect, attack. Deflect, attack. Bogdan lunged again, but Pasha suspected it was a feint. He didn't parry. Bogdan quickly recovered and changed tactics. Pasha dodged, but then he stumbled as a muscle in his abdomen cramped, exactly where Vika had extracted Nikolai's poisoned gear. Luckily, Bogdan was slow, at least in comparison to Pasha. Pasha inhaled sharply, forcing himself to ignore the cramp, and advanced to execute his own feint. Bogdan moved to parry. Not fast enough, though. Pasha circled his sword under Bogdan's and pressed the point of his blade against Bogdan's hairy chest, right in the center above his heart. Bogdan's nostrils flared like those of an incensed bull. He scowled down at Pasha. Pasha's muscles ached, but his hand was steady. A bit more pressure from his sword, and Bogdan's blood would spill. Bogdan glared at Pasha for another long moment. Then he dropped his sword on the ground and raised both hands in defeat. Suddenly, he began to laugh, a deep, rumbling belly laugh.
Not bad, pretty boy. Not bad.
Pasha held the cramp at his stomach.
I beg your pardon?
You're the best fighter here. Other than me, of course.
Pasha didn't point out that he had actually just defeated Bogdan.
How long are you in town, pretty boy? And how strong is your allegiance to the Imperial family? Do you really care about that bastard Cesarevich? Or were you just defending the late Tsarina's honor out of respect, as any good man should?
Bogdan shot a glare at Yuri. Yuri shrugged and giggled. Pasha carefully set his sword on the ground. As carefully as he could, he answered,
I don't think it's fair to insult the dead. They cannot defend themselves.
And what about the living?
Bogdan asked.
The living can fight.
Bogdan grunted in agreement.
We could use more men like you, especially since your company is stationed outside the city.
Pasha borrowed a bottle from a nearby soldier and took a couple of drinks before he spoke again.
What do you mean, you could use more men like me?
Do you believe in Russia?
Pasha nodded.
And do you believe all men are worth the same in God's eyes?
The soldiers around them began to chuckle under their breaths.
Watch out!
Yuri shouted, seeming to have forgotten that Pasha had been about to punch him not too long ago.
Bogdan will try to recruit you to fight the Cesarevich and kill his witch.
Bogdan glared at him.
It's all right,
Pasha lied.
I already know. Word has reached my company, too.
A crooked smile spread across Bogdan's face then, revealing a bear's worth of yellowed teeth.
Better than we'd hoped. We'll see you then, when we march against the Cesarevich and block his path to Moscow.
Pasha hesitated. The constitutionalists already had concrete plans. They were going to ambush him on the road next month, so he couldn't go to his coronation ceremony.
Don't look so worried,
Yuri said, pointing his near-empty bottle in their direction.
If you and your men don't show, Bogdan will single-handedly block the road. He'll just sit in the middle of it. And he'll sit on the witch, too!
The soldiers broke into rowdy guffaws and clinked bottles. Pasha pulled himself together and faked a hearty laugh along with them. But Bogdan didn't laugh. And inside, Pasha didn't either. Chapter 60. The creeping of Nikolai's energy, like those centipedes within her veins, still haunted Vika, even a couple of days later. It was powerful, of course, for Bolshevnoi Duplo's magic had only grown with the people's increasing fear, but there was something else to it that worried Vika more. It was restless, its hundreds of thousands of feet in non-stop motion, impatient to get wherever it was intending to go. And the fact that even before Aijana's death, before Nikolai had grown even colder and angrier, he tried to kill Pasha. This was why Vika had tasked herself with following Nikolai. Something was afoot, another plan, another attempt at the throne, and having fought against him in the game, she knew his next move would only escalate. The one benefit to not being permitted to use her powers was that she could trail him undetected. She didn't need to cast a barrier shroud around herself. She could simply wear a large brimmed hat and pull her scarf over her nose, and she blended in with the rest of the people hurrying through St. Petersburg, going from here to there, or generally trying to get out of the streets as soon as possible, in case of another magical debacle. Nikolai left his house in the early evening. Vika, with Poslanik riding in a pocket in her coat, kept some distance between them, but she never let him get too far. He walked briskly along Ekaterinsky Canal, then turned onto Nevsky Prospect. She hurried so she wouldn't lose him in the bustle of shoppers, which at this point consisted mostly of servants picking up crates of crackers, cured meats, pickles, and other provisions for their masters, who seemed, from the servants' hurried conversations, to think they might need to barricade themselves indoors in the event of magical apocalypse. It was the sort of scenario that ordinarily would have made Vika laugh for its ludicrousness. But given the violence of Nikolai's enchantments, she could not find even a splinter of humor in the people's reactions now. For a moment, she lost Nikolai in a sea of top hats that had emerged from Bizet and Sons. The shop was closing for the night, its customers released back into the world in a stream of bespoke suits and fine wool coats. The men began as a cluster, but then parted, and all began to go their separate directions, weaving this way and that through the crowds.
No, no, no!
Vika said, as her eyes tried to follow first this hat, then that one, then another.
I can't lose him, she muttered. I won't.
But in addition to that was the worry that this diversion was no mere coincidence.
Does Nikolai know I'm following him? Did he make those men spill out of Bizet and Sons all at once on purpose?
Not that that would deter Vika. It would just make trailing him more complicated. She focused on the hats again, their owners now spreading farther apart and away on their disparate paths. Black hat, narrow brim. Black hat, narrow brim. Another black hat with, a narrow brim.
Nikolai's hat would be different, though,
Vika thought. He wouldn't have purchased a hat like everyone else's. He would have crafted his own, for fashion was what Nikolai loved best in his rare moments of free time.
So what I need to find is a hat that isn't black, or that doesn't have a narrow brim.
She was too short to see over the heads and shoulders around her, and meanwhile, her target was getting away.
If only Vika could levitate.
Or climb a street lamp. She'd climbed many a tree growing up in the woods. A street lamp was not too different, except it was utterly inappropriate to scale a light in the middle of a city street. Vika grinned. She jumped up the base of the nearest street lamp and latched onto the pole, hoisting herself up as nimbly as a tree squirrel, with a bit of help from the Christmas garlands twined around the lamp. The people closest to her gasped. One servant dropped her bag into the snow. A little girl whined.
Papa, I want to do that too.
You should, Vika thought.
She winked at the girl.
Don't ever let the rules stop you.
Vika scanned the boulevard again. Black hat, narrow brim. Black hat, narrow brim. Black hat. Shinier and darker than others. Fabric that caught the lamplight and at the right angles rippled and shimmered like ink reflecting a candle flame. The hat also had a decidedly wider brim.
Aha!
Vika said.
Got you!
She hopped down from the street lamp and threaded through the crowd. Nikolai turned along the embankments of the Fontanka River. Vika veered after him and followed. Chapter 61. There were innumerable bridges along the waterways of St. Petersburg, but the Chernyshev Bridge over the Fontanka River had always been Nikolai's favorite, especially in the evening. It had four Doric pavilions carved from stone that housed the drawbridge mechanism. Being the mechanical sort, Nikolai particularly liked this fact, and the pavilions themselves looked like miniature palaces against the deep blue twilight sky. He leaned against the railing, staring out over the river, frozen in jeweled green. The color was the same shade as Vika's eyes, almost too deep and too mesmerizing to be real. But of course, the ice wasn't real, or at least its greenness wasn't, for it was the wintered result of one of Vika's earlier enchantments. Yet even though the water was frozen, Nikolai could still sense her magic floating off it, wild and powerful and scented with cinnamon, incongruent yet perfectly right. He inhaled deeply, closed his eyes, and thought of their kiss in the volcano dream. It only made him more morose. She turned him down again. People bustled behind him across the bridge. Nikolai kept himself well concealed, and the blue-purple darkness of the gloaming made short work of any lingering curiosity about the gentleman at the edge of the bridge. Eventually, footsteps approached Nikolai that were, in fact, meant for him.
"Your Imperial Highness,"
Ilya said into his own coat, so that no passers-by would hear. Nikolai nodded in greeting, but continued to look out over the river. Ilya came close enough that they could talk, but he too looked straight out over the river, such that it appeared the two boys were not conversing at all, but rather lost in thought over the sight of emerald ice.
"Our forces are shaping up beautifully,"
Ilya said.
"Trubetskoy has been officially appointed the leader of our movement, with Volkonsky and some of the others reporting directly to him.
The soldiers are already predisposed to join us, because so many of them are afraid of magic. Thus, our proposal for a constitution appeals to them, for it prevents sole power from resting in the Tsar, and, by association, his witch. I think it's looking good. The Decembrists are 20,000 strong.
Nikolai cocked his head.
The Decembrists?
Ilya grinned.
It has a daring sound to it, don't you think? I came up with it. It will unite us, make the soldiers feel a part of something important and grand.
The Decembrists, Nikolai said, letting the name tarry on his tongue.
I do like it, but I thought our plan was to move against Pasha in January. Why name us after this month? The timetable has moved up,
Ilya said.
The Cesarevich and Grand Princess learned of our original plans to block the coronation.
Nikolai looked away from the river at Ilya.
Yuliana,
he shook his head.
It was actually the Cesarevich this time. I overheard him telling his sister.
Right. You're one of his guard. Nikolai tapped his fingers on the bridge's railing.
So, then, we'll continue to use the plan to block the coronation as a decoy,
Ilya said.
Don't tell the soldiers it's a ruse, though,
Nikolai said.
The crown has its ears everywhere.
He gestured at Ilya, case in point. Ilya laughed under his breath.
Of course. We will continue to tell the soldiers that the plan is to target the coronation. But we have another, different opportunity the day after tomorrow. That's when the army is supposed to swear an oath of allegiance to the Cesarevich. But we'll refuse it.
Nikolai drummed his fingers on the railing of the bridge as he contemplated this. He knew what Ilya was talking about. Before the accession of every new Tsar, the Imperial Army held a symbolic ceremony, during which they swore their allegiance to the crown. There would be multiple ceremonies throughout St. Petersburg, held at each garrison. This was a better idea, actually. The problem with trying to block Pasha's coronation was the distance. The road to Moscow was long, and it would be difficult to coordinate the actions of the men from afar. But if the coup could happen right here in St. Petersburg, then Nikolai wouldn't have to wait weeks. He could secure the crown 2 days from now.
I like the new plan, Nikolai said,
pushing off from the railing. But what do you mean to do after refusing the oath?
Demand a constitution, and that you be put on the throne.
Nikolai shook his head.
Talk won't be enough. We need to march against Pasha to show our physical force, just as in our original plan to block his coronation.
Ilya looked over his shoulder to make sure no one was listening, then back out onto the river.
What do you suggest?
The ceremonies will be spread out all over the city. We need to assemble our forces together in one place after they reject the oath.
Palace Square?
Ilya suggested. Nikolai pictured where his Jack and ballerina had been.
No. If we have 20,000 men, the space is too small. We'd be trapped if a fight ensued.
He thumbed the brim of his hat as he thought.
What about Peter's Square?
Ilya nodded eagerly.
It's bigger.
Vika had returned the statue of Peter the Great to its place after its rampage on Nevsky Prospect.
Peter the Great came to life once to tell the people of the Cesarevich's wrongs, Nikolai said. The statue is the protector of our city. I like the symbolism of Peter the Great watching over us and our cause. Also, Nikolai thought, Peter's Square is personal.
Because that was where he had first told Pasha he would take the throne. It would be perfect to actually make good on his threat on the same site. If Nikolai weren't wearing a facade, his silhouette would have shaded a bit darker.
All right, Ilya said. I'll inform the Major General and Colonel of your wishes to march on Peter's Square.
20,000 men, you say?
Yes. And the remainder of the Imperial Army is far flung on the Kazakh steppe and near Missolonghi and elsewhere. Therefore, we ought to meet little resistance. The Cesarevich and Grand Princess will have only their guards.
Minus me, of course.
And they'll have Vika, Nikolai thought. Surely